My apologies for getting out of the starting gate too early there. I must confess, at the end of Mr. McCready's comments, I had lost concentration. I was looking over some notes, but that happens. Anyway, we're here and ready to go. I did want to just comment a little bit. We do have the ABC class coming in. We accepted a last-minute student just this past week, and she had finally decided she wanted to come, and I think some of the family, her family, had arranged help with the financing. So she asked if she could make it. And in her case, she didn't have to travel far. She's actually from Ohio. So that worked out really well. But we looks like we'll have 40 students, which our average over the, we take all the years together, and we're beginning our 14th year at Ambassador Bible Center. We average the years together, we have about 38. And the median age, the age of where most of our students land, is 21. And in fact, that is totally consistent with all the years we've had ABC. The median age is 21 or 22. One year it was 20.7, but that's 21 when you round it up. So we have, even having gone through what we've gone through, we have a full complement of class. A lot of eager young people and a few eager older people who add maturity and balance to the class. We have a gentleman from Pennsylvania who is 75, but doesn't look 75. He attended some classes back in Ambassador College days a long time ago because my wife remembers him attending some of the classes with her class, her year that was going through Ambassador College in Pasadena. So we're looking forward to having him and actually several others. There's another gentleman who is 70. He and his wife are coming, and their granddaughter from out on the West Coast. So it's just going to be an exciting year. We have several older ones. Last year we did too. You know, Larry was there, helped provide some steadiness and balance for the lads. And then we had the Edelbach sisters-in-law from Minnesota, who provided the grandmother oversight of the class as well. So that we're always happy to have some of our older members to be a part of the Ambassador Bible Center class. A lot of energy, though, among the younger ones, and we have, I think, total of 13 from Oregon and Washington, from the Pacific Northwest, plus several more from California. So the West Coast is very well represented this year at the ABC. The Alumni Association, Mr. McCready commented on that. I coordinate that, and I just coordinate. I don't direct. I coordinate the continuing education seminars. They are much appreciated. Yours was in Michigan City. We had lots of positive reviews from Spokane, Washington, where Aaron Dean and I conducted one in July. The other thing I coordinate is the Alumni Association, and we really haven't had an Alumni Association. It's been rather happenstance. The alumni get together, some of them there in home office, and they do something, a service project usually once a year for the Ronald McDonald House. Well, we gathered up a small group of those who were really keenly interested in helping reorganize or organize an Alumni Association. We've had several meetings, and we decided, clearly, when you begin to look at what alumni associations do, they help the alma mater, and that is the school they came from. Technically, alma mater is Latin for nourishing mother, which is how the educational institution is viewed. And I said, our priority is to help ABC. Then, any other time that we can, or service projects for other things, we'll do that. And probably starting with the charities that the church itself is involved in, Good Works and Life Nets, and then extending out as the opportunity arises. What we're planning to do is to establish some sort of a chapter program for the Alumni Association so that where we have concentrations of ABC alumni, I know we do have in Oregon quite a few there, and a few other areas, there are numbers of them, that they too can then sponsor alumni activities and carry on the work that we're trying to do. We did our first project last week, and next time I come, I'll bring along a video of that we made of it. But we had the alumni gather to refurbish the backyard of the home office. It was in dire need of that. Our plant manager, Tim Sipes, looks after the warehouse, does the mail runs, does the shipping of the big packages of things that need to be shipped internationally or wherever. And then on top of that, he tries to maintain the grounds. And he runs out of hours fast. So some things he simply can't reach. So the tables and chairs, for those of you who have been there, we have these all-metal patio furniture chairs. Eight tables, the big round 5-foot round tables, and 40 chairs. And they were in a terrible state of rusted dilapidation. So we bought some wire brushes and gave a crew of half a dozen the job of brushing off the loose rust. And we pulled out 2 cases of Rust-Oleum spray paint and spray painted all of those. So they look really nice now. And then some of the rest of us got busy on the landscaping, including Larry. He brought his power trimmer, and he trimmed all of the hedges all around the back and around to the front. And then we did a lot of weeding. We had trees growing inside of trees. We have 2 beautiful roses of Sharon, but one of them had a sucker maple tree coming up bigger than the rose of Sharon. And it looked ugly, so we went in there with a saw, cut that out, trimmed out some other things. It just really looks a lot better. We have a couple of giants in the Alumni Association, Mark Tannert being one of those. So I have an extender pole with a little saw on it. So he walked around under the ash trees and ratcheted that pole out to where he could reach way high and pulled out all the dead branches of the ash trees. So they look better. So it just really does look nice, thanks to all the team that we had. About 24, 25 people were there for most of 6 hours, working hard. And then we had a lunch. One of the fellows grilled hamburgers. And as it turns out, we found out that the grill was not clean, nor was it even functioning properly. So he thoroughly cleaned the grill so it can be used for, well, the local church uses it sometimes, and ABC does. And then he made our hamburgers. And we had, while we were eating, we did introductions around the tables. And who you are, what class you graduated in at ABC, and what was your favorite memory, and then the final question, which was really the one we wanted answered, you just warm up with the other questions. What are your aspirations for the Alumni Association? So they talked about that and articulated right away some of the thoughts that the small group that we've been working with, that we'd been having and jotting down, and without prompting, it was coming out of all of them. So it is a desire to support the Ambassador Bible Center program and do what we can to help with that, whether it's helping take care of the building and the grounds, as well as small fundraisers for equipment we might need for the ABC, because it does produce a tremendous value of education for the church. We added up how many have gone through ABC, and it is well over 400. And one of the fellows who did the adding had done that, and somebody said, "What'd you do? Go down the hallway and count people in the pictures?" He said, "Exactly what I did." We got a picture of every class hanging on the wall there right outside Mr. Antion's office, and he counted everybody. Over 400, well over 400. With this class, you know, we'll be probably on the top end of 450. So we'll definitely be on the top end of 450 and closing in on 500, actually. So that's quite a few in UCG that have had the Ambassador Bible Center education. And that's a huge asset. That level of Bible knowledge and motivation, some of those young men that have gone through there are now elders, some deacons. Most are, you know, young pillars in the church and growing and doing well. Those who are older who have benefited from it, you know, that comes out in messages and in their, you know, their counseling and that we do with each other, peer counseling within the congregation. There's a lot of benefits. And in a way, Ambassador College was that in its day, in Ambassador University. It was an intellectual engine for the church. And that kept us on a higher pitch of thinking. instead of just devolving down to everything in the work is basically what I see around me here on the Sabbath, just us brethren here in Dayton or whatever city it happens to be. We have this engine where we're eager to learn more of God's way. We know we're sending some of our young and our best and some of our old and our best to go and get deeper education in the Bible. And we have this concept, and it keeps us very active in our minds, that we're reaching the world. And we need to train people to be able to do that. And the benefit of the training comes right back to the congregation with those who return to their home areas. So anyway, I wanted to update you a little bit on that and rattle on a bit about the Alumni Association. We're very happy with the project they did last Sabbath. And then tomorrow, or not last Sabbath, last Sunday, tomorrow they have their next project, which is sponsoring the welcome picnic for all the new students. So we're doing a pioneering theme. We decided that pioneers must have had ropes. So Tim Sipes has his lariats out. And we decided that pioneers probably borrowed Indian equipment to hunt buffalo at least once. So I'll be teaching archery. You have to work with history just a little bit to make things fit. And then we have all kinds of other pioneer sort of adventures, or adapted as such, from a scavenger hunt to, we're going to have a Virginia reel dance so that everybody learns a Virginia reel. That gets some mixed up together. And then we have a sing-along to cap off the afternoon of some pioneer songs, Sweet Betsy from Pike and Oh My Darling Clementine. I don't know. Were gold miners pioneers? I guess they were, weren't they? I was talking to Diane Bailey, whose office is next door. She's Mr. Luker's secretary. And I said, we're going to have Oh My Darling Clementine. Oh, she said, that's such a sad song. I said, why? Well, she's dying. You don't like the one where it says, saw her lips above the water, blowing bubbles, mighty fine. But alas, I lost my Clementine. I don't like that part at all. It's sad. I said, don't worry about it. It was a sluice box. It was the gold miner's sluice box, basically an enlarged sluice box, where he poured the gravel on it and then had the water sort of channeled up to trickle over it, and then it would sift out the gold flakes. It said, and it got washed into the river and it sank. That's why herring boxes without tops as sandals were for Clementine. He got herring boxes probably from San Francisco, and so he was up out of Sacramento in the gold rush of California. That's where it came from. Then she didn't feel so bad. So Clementine was just a sluice box. But it came from a pioneering era, and it's a fun song to sing. So we're going to be doing that tomorrow. Then on Monday, we have the orientation for the students, starting in the morning and extending into the beginning of the afternoon. Then they get a thorough tour of the facility there. Some of them have already done that, but I think they'll probably do it again. And then Tuesday morning, 8:30, we're right hard at it and in the full swing of classes. And it is a challenge. It's basically seminar-style learning. There are not a lot of tests. We have some tests. There's a lot of interaction in the lecturing, but you're being lectured to for about 7 hours a day. And the challenge is to stay alert and, take down as much as you can. We try to make it as interesting as possible as far as instructors go, but still, it's a challenge. And they'll be right in, find out what kind of a challenge it is. I'm teaching a new class, so I've got to finish my notes for this. It's called Biblical Geography. It's really historical geography. The students need a sense of place and time. They need to be able to know where Jerusalem is, where Gath is, where Jericho is, where Dan was, where Beersheba is, where all these different places in the Holy Land. And then they need to know where the Persian Empire was and the Assyrian Empire was, and where Greece came through and where Egypt was and where the route of the Exodus and all of this being able to look at the map and say, oh yeah, I can see that. And if possible, look at Google Earth, unless you can travel there. But you need a map. Even if you travel someplace, you need a map to get a perspective of where you're at. I think we all are aware of that, which is why I think it's a good feature on the Garmin. You can push the button and it will break out into a map. Otherwise, you just, you know, wait for the lady with the English voice to say, it's take the slip road on the right. That's the exit ramp or the entrance ramp. In England, they call them slip roads. We like the British voice best for being told what to do. American voice is kind of harsh. The Australians are way too soft-spoken. And Amanda understands the French, but I don't. So we go with the English lady most of the time. And occasionally, the English butler. He sounds like a butler anyway. And so his directions are very clear and easy to understand as well. But you have that sense of place where you can break back from the immediate turn you're going to make, and you can see this map expand out. And you've got maps in the backs of your Bibles. I encourage you to look at them from time to time. And when you read of a place, then turn to the map and say, oh, that's where Syria was then. It's not hard. Syria was where Syria is. That's one place that didn't really change. Tyre and Sidon, we call them Phoenicians. The Phoenicians was a Greek term for Israelites, Jews, and Tyronians and Sidonians. But that would be Lebanon. That was the area of Lebanon, is where Tyre and Sidon were located, right? The north of the modern state of Israel, which is pretty much within its boundaries of what the ancient promised land was. So we'll be going through the geography, and then accompanying that will be an extensive timeline. I have 2 hours a day for 4 days, so it's really an orientation class, high-speed delivery, but it will give them a sense of when things happened and where, relative to other things that happened outside of the biblical record. And I think that'll be beneficial, and I think you'd frankly find it interesting and helpful. Someday, when I'm up here, I'll give you a timeline sermon. I would have done that today, but the whiteboards were too small. We're talking about a lot of time, you know, from eternity to eternity. But that's not what I'm talking about today. I want to tell you a story. My father had a cousin. His name was Bill Russell. And Bill's dead now. I didn't know him very well. We lived in South Dakota when he came to visit. I remember when I was very small, he came to see us in Nebraska. But he was living in Wyoming, western or eastern Wyoming, not far from the Nebraska border, but not in a very good area. He had to have a lot of cliffs. Is my thinking. I'll explain why I think that was the case in a minute. But he was a man who could face adversity with a cheerful heart. And the visit that he came in the middle of summer, and he's a farmer. Well, why wasn't he putting up his hay and getting ready to harvest his crop? Well, it actually wasn't the middle of summer, it was August. Should have been irrigating, like we were. But he didn't have to anymore. He said, well, this is what happened. The tractor broke down during planting season. And so that planting was late. And it was this went wrong and this went wrong because the tractor broke down. He just had one tractor. He was just, you know, eking in existence there. And he said, but if you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next. The crops came up, such as got planted, and the grasshoppers came. He had a plague of grasshoppers that nearly wiped the crop out entirely, stunted it worse than it was from the late planting. But he said, if you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next. And we said, what happened next? He said, hail. Oh, we thought, okay, well, we know hail. We have it every year because we live near cliffs. Hail has to have updrafts because it's an ice particle. You get layers of air. Some of them are freezing air and some are not. And so then this ice particle forms around a raindrop, becomes ice, starts down, and then it hits this upthrust wind, and that pushes it back up into the freezing section, and it lays on another layer of frozen water. And the stronger the updrafts, the bigger the hailstones. And then finally they overpower the updraft, or it quits, and then down they come. What's really bad is when you get a downdraft, sending them down like bullets. And we had golf ball size hail in South Dakota we took our turn being hailed out twice in a row, 2 years in a row. Anyway, it only took 1 year for Bill. That was all the resources he had. He had softball size hailstones. He had a picture. He gathered up 9 of them and put them in a half bushel basket, and they filled it. He said, because we'd had hail would kill our chickens. We'd chase them into the chicken house right away as soon as we heard a hailstorm was coming. Get the chickens in, or it would kill a lot of chickens. It killed cattle. It killed his chickens in the chicken pen because it came through the roof. And he said, he still had a smile on his face, so I got to come and visit you. I'm out of business. I don't know what I'm going to do next. Well, he survived. He found a way to provide for his family and lived his life out. But you know what made me stop and think? That was such a remarkable story. And he had us laughing and then almost crying and then laughing and then almost crying. And, you should have seen what happened next. So the title of the sermon is called Worst Case Faith. Worst Case Faith. What kind of faith do you need when you're facing the worst case? Most difficult things you can imagine. And it doesn't take much imagination, we know. We broke away from the office this past week. We had two families up in the Columbus-Cambridge area that we needed to go see. Mr. Hargrove asked if we would. And one particularly I'll ask your prayers for is Marlene McCready. Marlene McCready. She has advanced cancer and is now at home under hospice care. So please be praying for God's intervention for her. Well, wonderful servant. She did our church bulletin for 20 years. She only took a break a few years ago for about a year and a half, when she was nursing her mother who died of cancer, shortly after her father had died of cancer. And now she has it. So, what do you do when you come to that point where you're facing, in a health case situation, a worst case? And yet, she reminds me an awful lot of my father's cousin, because we went up to the hospital to visit her. Her husband was there, and she was as cheerful as she always has been in all the years we've known her. But it's a good lesson. We do have trials. We have lived a pretty comfortable life, but Peter said, don't be surprised, the apostle did, in 1 Peter chapter 4. It's a good starting point here. Don't be surprised when you're facing what you might call worst case, your worst case in any particular circumstances. It's 1 Peter chapter 4. Did I say 5? I meant 4. Chapter 4 and verse 12. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. And that really comes into focus when we're facing what we consider in a situation to be the worst case. And that's when faith, the rock-solid foundation of faith is needed. We need faith every day. Faith to move forward. Faith to live. We have to believe God. We have to believe in God. We have to believe the gospel. We have to believe in the gospel. And we have to believe. And we do. But our belief is tested by the fiery trial. So what kind of faith, and how do you ensure it being there when you're facing the worst case? Let me just reread the verse again. Beloved, do not think it strange. Don't be surprised. It's okay. It's not unusual. It's something that, frankly, we can expect in one way or another as we go through our lives and as we ramp up to the end of this age. Bear in mind, worst case faith is required more than ever right at the end of the age. Which is actually what Peter was talking about. He was talking about persecution. He wasn't talking necessarily about severe health trials, which is one of our main things. He was talking about persecution. We haven't faced persecution. We haven't been beaten. We have not resisted to bloodshed, as Paul said. We haven't been beaten because of what we believe. That's happening to people who are Christians. The Coptic Egyptians, about 10 million of them, have got to get out of that country, or they will be exterminated by the Muslim extremists who have taken over Egypt. You read the news. Just today, you read the news, you see that that's... They're realizing they have got to try to get out. Those who can't get out, can't find asylum someplace, are facing what the Jews faced in Germany. They will be exterminated, and they will be tortured, because the people who do that take fiendish, devilish pleasure in that. Very Roman in their outlook. They started using crucifixion as one of their preferred ways of punishing those who call themselves Christians. And those Christians don't understand true Christianity. It's sobering times, but don't be surprised. This is what we expect. It's okay. God will be with us. Because we have to, but we have to have strong, worst case faith. So, what is it that we would see as the obstacle when we're facing our worst case, health case or persecution or whatever it happens to be that we might have to face? What do we need? As I said, we need to believe, but we sometimes have doubts about whether we believe. Let's turn to Mark 9 and read an episode where Jesus healed a young lad. Well, I don't know how young, but he was probably, I'm guessing, corresponds to being a teen. Did you know that teenagers didn't exist before World War II? Nobody talked about teenagers. It was a new word after World War II. Americans suddenly had money, and so sellers of things realized that there was a youthful market who were in their teens, and so they coined the term teenager and started marketing, selling things to them. Before that, you were a young man or a young woman once you hit about 13. You know, and some parts of the culture maintained that. Where I grew up, as soon as you could reach the controls on the tractor, you got to drive the tractor, and you would be doing it for hours and hours. But that was after you finished your chores, milking the cows, haying the horses, taking care of the chickens. And then you would do that again when you finished driving the tractor. So being a teenager was different in some, even later on, in some parts of the world than in others. But I think this young fellow was probably a teen. We start in verse 14. I think it's verse 14. Yes, it is. And he came to his disciples. He saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. Now, the scribes would have been Pharisees and Sadducees, perhaps a mix, probably more Pharisees in this case. And immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed and running to him and greeted him, and he asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Meaning with his disciples. It sounds like he's a little suspicious. Probably, and with good reason, because the scribes were nefarious rascals. Then one of the crowd answered, you know, somebody stepped forward. He said, "Teacher, I have brought you my son." He didn't bring his son to Christ's disciples or to the scribes. He brought him to Christ for healing. But Christ wasn't there at the moment, but he brought him where he thought that he would find him, and he did finally here. "I have brought you my son who has a mute spirit." So there's a demonic influence. This is not biological ailment. "And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid." Now, some would say, "Well, that sounds like epilepsy." Well, the symptoms are that, but in this case, it's not caused by epilepsy, which is biological. This is, as I say, this is actually demonically caused. "So I spoke to your disciples and they should cast it out, but they couldn't." So Jesus is taking this all in. Everybody runs to him. You know, he was the authority, and whether the scribes and the Pharisees wanted to admit it or not, they ended up looking to him that way. And this is a good case in point. And he said, "Oh, faithless generation." Oh. So this was a worst case for this gentleman and for his son. But he says, "Oh, faithless generation." He's not singling the man out. He's talking to the whole group there and beyond. "How long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." So this was, remember, the disciples were apostles in training. They hadn't graduated to be apostles yet. They were still in training. Though they brought him to him, and when he saw him, and when he, the boy, saw Christ, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. Just a pitiful sight. And he said to his father, Jesus said to his father, how long has this been happening? You know, a reasonable question. And he says, from childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Referring to himself, his son, probably his wife and rest of his family. You can imagine the strain of trying to keep your dear little son alive from childhood. That's why I'm thinking he's a young man by now, in his teens or maybe older teens. Years he has been plagued with this demonic influence. And Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. And you got to stop and think about it. That's what Christ said there. If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. When we ask God for something, you know, first we want to make sure we're not asking just selfishly, but asking for the right things. We have to believe. Believing, having faith, is vital. The word for to believe and for faith are the same Greek word, and you know, its variations depending on the grammatical usage of the term. We do that in English. You know, you gotta really believe, or you gotta have faith in this. Because depending on the context, we'll use one word or the other. So the Greek word was the same Greek word, basically, with its slight variations off of the main root. All things are possible to him who believes. Being human as we are, it is hard to probe the depths of that part of the statement. All things are possible for him who believes. Immediately the father and the child cried out and said with tears, and just imagine yourself in his position. You'd be crying too. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. He knew that he didn't have perfect faith. He knew that he needed to believe more deeply. And so he not only said that he believes, but he asked that Christ would help him believe more and more deeply. Now, it's interesting. He says this, and then he looks around again. Christ hears what the man says. He looks at him, and he's crying. Maybe he puts a hand on the shoulder, and he looks at the crowd. You know, he was the commander in the setting. And when Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more. And Christ had that authority. Boom. The spirit cried out, which meant that the sound came from the boy, of course, but through him it cried out, and convulsed him greatly and came out of him. And he, the boy, became as one dead. It looked like he was dead. He just was laying there still on the ground. So that many said, he's dead. You know how a crowd panics? Try to avoid that. I mean, if you're in a crowd, try to avoid panicking. And if somebody around you is panicky, put a hand on the shoulder and say, it's going to be okay, stand by. But Jesus took him by the hand. Now, you just see the scene here. The father, you know, some of the scribes came, and the disciples are coming up probably on the flanks of the scribes, and then the man with the boy comes through the crowd, the smaller crowd initially. The rest are still out at a little distance. And so all of this conversation has taken place in the smaller knot of people. And then the crowd starts running forward when they hear Christ saying something authoritatively, probably with a fairly loud voice. And then they see the poor little lad thrashing around and then just going still on the ground. So they're running. And Christ, you know, bent over and took the boy by the hand, and life came back into him. He wasn't dead in this case anyway. He was just drained of all energy. Christ took him by the hand and pulled him toward him. and helped him to his feet. You know, maybe he got to where he could get an elbow and a hand behind his back and sort of help him back up onto his feet beside his father there. Try to imagine the scene so you can appreciate what he said. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. And when he came into his house, or rather when he came into the house, which may have been his house, Christ was not a pauper, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? We, you know, you gave us authority over the demons and we tried to do it, but it wouldn't leave. And he said to them, this kind comes out only by prayer and fasting. Now you say, what do you mean this kind? You mean there are various levels of strength among the demons? Yes. Dittos among the holy angels. Some have higher authority within the angelic realm. Some are just, you know, they have personality and individual characteristics in many respects as we do. And that's why he said this kind come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. Or the Son of God himself stepping in. You know, because when Christ had a whole lot more authority than the disciples had. A whole lot more authority. Infinitely more. But when we face worst case faith, we need to realize that we believe. That's why we're here on a day-to-day basis. That's why we acted on the calling that God gave us. That's why we repented and we were baptized and whoever the minister was at the time laid hands upon us for the receiving of God's Spirit. That's why we're here. But we have to know that we need more faith. And in many respects, we never have enough. We've got to have more, just like this father had to have more. And he knew that, and he asked for it. So this is, that in a sense, is the how-to of worst-case faith. We have to have more faith, so we have to ask for more of it. We have to use it when we have it. Now, let's go and look next at an episode in David's life. It's in Psalm 60. And you think, well, how can that be an episode? That'll be a song. Well, okay, we'll read the introduction and you'll see it's an episode in his life, which he sang about. David was one of those people that sang about things. I was catching some of the news driving up here on NPR, because that's the only place you can get news on a Sabbath morning. And, you know, you get this potpourri of news. You get a little bit of world news, and then they're going to interview a musician or something like that. So, you know, I'm blandly listening to that. But here's a fellow with a pleasant voice, and he's from the Northwest, so I thought, well, I've been there, so I'm curious. He plays an oboe. No, he doesn't. He thought about playing an oboe, but he said they looked too uncomfortable. So he plays a bassoon. And he's a really good bassooner, or a bassoonist, or whatever it's called. But I was listening to him talking about playing his bassoon and making music about everything in his life. He said, I drove my mother crazy. He's fairly young lad, in university age. I drove my mother crazy. I hummed and sang all the time because I had all these tunes going. He composes his own music, a lot of it, and it's quite good. I've heard his stuff before. I don't know why I can't remember his name. But he said, I hummed and I sang constantly until she got me into music lessons. Then I had an outlet for my music. And then eventually he was studying one place and ended up going from the Pacific Northwest, I don't know, Washington or Oregon, to someplace ugly in Michigan, where it's, you know, the big city and it's cold in the wintertime, and from the lush green of the Pacific Northwest to the lush gray of Detroit or wherever the school is. It's a highly respected music school where now he studies. And so he makes music all the time, and he likes being there. When he's down in the basement of the building where he lives in, they have practice rooms. So the different musicians are all down there practicing and working on their compositions or working on their performances. And you can go knock on the next door over and you can go in. Now listen to this and tell me what you think. And you can try it out. And he says it's a very positive, collaborative, setting for his kind of work. David must have done that, because this episode he made into a song. Like I said, David had tunes going through his head, so he wrote history and music. So notice the introduction, which is part of the biblical record. It's part of verse 1, essentially. To the chief musician, set to the lily of the testimony. Oh, yeah, the lily of the testimony. That goes ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. We don't have any idea how it goes. But David knew, and so did everybody else. It was a really popular tune, top 40 on back in, 1020 B.C. Set to the lily of the testimony, a michum, or a song of David, for teaching. So it's an instructive psalm. Interesting. When he fought against Mesopotamia and Syria of Zobah. I didn't explain where Syria also included the backyard of Moab and Ammon and Edom. So Syria at times extended all the way down into what would be Jordan, on the other side of the Transjordan Mountains. So that was the... David kind of took on everybody in the region, is what he's saying. And he had to go up against Zobah. Zobah, when you go back and read it in 2 Samuel, he had 1,000 war chariots. And David took those from him. He had 600 horsemen. Why they had such a small cavalry when they had a big charioteers, but they didn't understand the value of cavalry yet. And 20,000 infantry captured the army. But the war chariots were the powerhouses of the time. He kept 100 chariots. And he hamstrung the rest of the horses. I don't know why he didn't take the horses. I guess he didn't like horses as much as Solomon did. But that way they couldn't use those trained chariot horses for chariots anymore. So he specifically weakened them. Now, I don't think he meant he completely hamstrung them when you cut the tendon on the back of the hock of the horse. He probably cut part of it so that the horse could be used, but not for pulling a chariot. Nor could he run very fast. That was just a way of weakening the enemy and yet not completely destroying your enemy, because he became a part of David's empire. So he's facing this, and let's see, what else? Syria of Zobah, and Joab returned and killed 12,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. All of this stuff is happening. He had to send Joab with a part of the army to go and deal with the Edomites while he's dealing with Zobah and the Syrians and Mesopotamia. That's like the Fertile Crescent. He's fighting all the way out to the Euphrates. He's spread thin, and he's got many enemies, and he ends up being surrounded. And we don't get all of the details in the record, but you get the sense of it in the psalm, because from that comes a song. O God, you have cast us off. You have broken us down. You have been displeased. Oh, restore us again. It's a prayer psalm is what it is. Restore us again. You have made the earth tremble and you have broken it. And when the chariots are charging and the cavalry is charging, the earth trembles. And the roar of horses' hooves, lots of horses' hooves, is terrifying. Especially if they're aimed at you. And you know that there are unkind men astride or riding in the chariot, at least unkind toward you. And you have broken, the earth is trembling, you have broken it. Heal its breaches, for it is shaking. And then verse 3, you have shown your people hard things. Okay, what we're now looking at here, this was one of the worst case situations that David faced. Now, we don't fight in battle and war. The kingdom of God is not of this world. We are of the kingdom of God. At that time, Israel had long before chosen to fight its own battles. Then God used it at times because it was a physical nation. It wasn't converted like the church is converted now. We're spiritual Israel. That was physical Israel. So periodically, he used the nation of Israel to discipline or punish other nations for their sins. And sometimes he used other nations to punish Israel. Syria and Babylon, two classic cases in point. So you have shown your people hard things. Thus we can draw spiritual lessons from this event. You have made us drink the wine of confusion. And sometimes we feel like that. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, because I know it's there, back and forth. You have given a banner to those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of the truth, that your beloved may be delivered. Save with your right hand and hear me. So he's making all the reasons why he needs God to intervene. God has spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and measure out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine, and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is the helmet for my head. Judah is my lawgiver. Now, this is an interesting verse that has to do, because I'm going to make an aside comment here, with our Tribe Trackers Guide to History lecture that I give, which I would be happy to give up here sometime when we can get it organized. It takes a few, more than a sermon. Gilead is the half-tribe of Manasseh. Gilead was the grandson of Manasseh. So where part of Manasseh settled was labeled as Gilead. Manasseh would be the main settlement of Manasseh, which was immediately north of Ephraim on the west side of the Jordan River. Half-tribe was on the east side of the Jordan River. So we have Manasseh, we have Ephraim. Manasseh and Ephraim were what tribe, what one tribe originally? Joseph, tribe of Joseph. And then Judah is my lawgiver. So we have here the two dominant tribes of the 10, or of the 12, are Joseph and Judah. Joseph got the birthright, Judah got the scepter. And this is another reference to that. Now, David, if this is God speaking, of course, about Gilead is his, and Manasseh and Judah is his lawgiver. And I will divide Shechem and measure out in the valley of Succoth. Moab is my washpot, goes on to say. And over Edom I will cast my shoe. What does it mean in the Middle East when you take your shoe off and throw it at somebody? You don't like them. That is a major insult. It doesn't have that same thing concept here in America, but it did anciently, and it still does. Remember the Islamic reporter that took his shoe off and threw it at President Bush one time? And that was a huge insult. Well, when they pulled down the statues of Saddam Hussein in 2003, the men in the villages would take their sandals off and beat on the statue with their sandals, you know, indicating that they were stomping on their enemy. So, over Edom I will cast my shoe. Philistia, shout in triumph because of me. Who will bring me to the strong city? Who will lead me to Edom? Is it not you, O God? Now we come back to David speaking there in verse 9. Is it not you, O God, who cast us off? Who will bring us to where we need to go? Isn't it you who cast us off and let us have trials? And you, O God, who did not go out with our armies, you let us go on our own because you showed us hard things that we needed to learn. We faced a worse case because we weren't following you closely. So the result is, the solution is, give us help from trouble, for the help of man is useless. Through God we will do violently. And I think two of the key lines here are the first, the second line of verse 11 and the first line of chapter 12, or verse 12, sorry. Those two lines, for the help of man is useless, through God we will do valiantly. For it is he who shall tread down our enemies. When we face a worst case faith, it is God who will help us, not man. And we need to remember that. We have to go to God first and foremost. You know, Job said, I'll cite an example for you in Job chapter 13. Now, Job had his problems. He was working through that. One of my chief joys is to teach the book of Job in the second semester and make the students write a short paper called Job and I. You know, compare your life with Job's and what you learn from him. So Job was defending himself constantly. And in chapter 13 and verse 5, he makes in the first line, he says, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Referring to God. Even if God kills me, if he allows me to die, I will trust him. However, I will argue my case before him that I'm a pretty good guy. You know, that was what Job had to come to grips with, and he did. But one of the reasons why he could deal with his worst case faith situation, when you have to admit it was bad. You know, all his children died, all his wealth is gone, and his wife is angry with him, and then his health disappears, and he is miserable. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. He still had that anchor of a faith that, like the man who with the demon-possessed son, who said, "I believe, help thou my unbelief." In the King James, "help thou." New King James doesn't do thou anymore. Let's notice in Habakkuk, just because it's hard to find, chapter 3. See, this is a technique in speaking. If we look out and we see people, "Oh, boy, he's sure boring today." All you got to do is say, "All right, let's turn to Habakkuk." "Oh, not Habakkuk. Find Obadiah." Oh, and it wakes you right up. You're thumbing, "Where in the world?" Anyway, here it is. Habakkuk 2:4. You already know that one. You could have stayed asleep if I'd have said Habakkuk 2 verse 4, "The just shall live by faith." Because that got quoted in the New Testament 2 or 3 times. But it's Habakkuk 3, and you think, whoa, what in the world is in Habakkuk 3? Well, how about a song? From song to song, so it's a hymn, a psalm. The last 3 verses of Habakkuk 3. And, in fact, it has instructions at the end instead of the beginning. It says, "To the chief musician with my stringed instruments." Of course, the question is, well, you mean Habakkuk's stringed instruments or somebody else's stringed instruments? Verse 17, let's go to the actual lines. "Though the fig tree may not blossom, no fruit be on the vines, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd on the stalls." Well, hold it. This doesn't sound good. First of all, the fig tree doesn't blossom. Why? Or maybe it's a plague, killed all the figs. I don't know if you like figs. I love figs. Figs and dates are delicious. Good for you, too. But when the fig tree doesn't blossom, and that's one of your mainstays of food supply, that's really bad. "Nor fruit be on the vines, no grapes." What are you going to do for raisins? "Though the labor of the olive may fail." Yeah, well, we just go to Kroger's. If they don't have any olives, I'll go to Meijer's. I'm okay. Yeah, not if you have a crop failure. We will run through the supplies that are in the pipeline rather quickly. We don't use olives as a mainstay of our diet. They did. We use olive oil. They used it more than we do. But still, whoa, that would be tough. "Well, that's okay. We'll just use soy oil." Never mind that it produces, you know, synthetic estrogen, which isn't necessarily good for you. Well, if this all is happening, you aren't going to have any soy oil either. You know, today we would say, "Though the corn wilts and the soybeans, you know, dry up and blow away, and what else is left?" Not much. Wheat. Corn, soybeans, and wheat. Well, we grow a little barley, a little rye in America, but mostly it's soybeans and corn and wheat. And if they're gone, we think, well, it's all right, we just go to the grocery store. You know, they manufacture food there, don't they? Nope, they don't. "Though the flock may be cut off from the fold," in other words, livestock could be wiped out by some kind of plague. A drought, and so then you have to butcher, which happened in Texas. They had to kill off a significant percentage of their brood herds, of the big cattle herds. And you think, well, that's not a problem. It rains now down there. Okay, yeah, it does. But where are those cows? Well, I just go to Kroger's and get some more. All right. You can't do that. They have to rebuild the herd slowly so that there's no herd in the stalls. We're talking about catastrophic situation here. This is definitely worst case faith situation. And the answer is, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on the high hills. I watch deer go uphill, and I don't think they understand gravity very well. They shouldn't be able to do what they do. They run up slopes. In the West, we hunted elk with bows and arrows, which was lots of fun. Didn't hurt the herd very much, but you had to chase them all the time. When you find them, you'd chase them through the woods. And in, it was the Coast Range of Oregon, which, you know, it's not that high. 3,000 feet were high peaks. 3,500 was max. But they were so stinking steep. And those elk just ran straight up the hill whenever they wanted to. And that would be neat. They don't have gravity, and I do. And I have to wear glasses, so then I'd have to stop, you know, every while and take my glasses off and do this and try to get some of the heat expelled from the body so your glasses don't fog up instantly. I don't think any of the Indians had glasses. They had an advantage. Back to our lesson. In a catastrophic situation, definitely a worst-case faith situation, which is the kind of situation we're facing. Go read about the drought. Read about the fact that the Mississippi in some areas is running at one-third of volume. You can stand on the bottom of the Mississippi River, dry-shod right now in many areas. What would have been under many feet of water, you can actually stand on. We have a serious drought, and depending on what God does with that, depending on how this election goes, depending on this, depending on that, depending on a lot of other things, we don't know how close we are to the end, but we do know that we are headed into what is called in Jeremiah chapter 30 and verse 7, the time of Jacob's trouble. It is a time of Jacob's trouble. You think, oh man, that's awful. This is Jacob's trouble language here in Habakkuk. But the last part of verse 7 in chapter 30 of Jeremiah is, but he shall be saved out of it. Oh, good. That's a lesson. You've got to look forward to God's salvation. Even if it means that we die in persecution or we give our life for God and for his word, which could happen, we end up being saved spiritually and eternally out of it. And you've got to look at that. The Apostle Paul looked at that in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. This is a major description of it. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, a worst-case situation. And Paul didn't back down from persecution. In a way, he was driven toward it because he had persecuted others. He was the creator, before he was converted, a creator of worst-case faith situations for a lot of the new brethren in the church. Some he had Gestapo-like arrested in the night, beaten and tortured, and others even killed for believing the truth because he was a Jewish zealot, and then God called him. He never seemed to back down from any trouble. He seemed to go like a magnet toward it. Chapter 4, I want to read, though, the section of this. As he talks about what he, and you go back in Acts and you can read it all. You know this, the record is there and what he went through. So we'll start in verse 7 and go to the end of the chapter. Verse 7 says, but this treasure we have in earthen vessels, meaning our bodies. You know, we're made out of soil. We are of the earth, earthy. We have this treasure in earthen vessels that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. And we glorify God. Facing a worst case situation, glorify God. That's what Habakkuk did. That's what David did. That's what Paul does. And not of us. We are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. He was no aluminum can. We are perplexed, but not in despair. It's puzzling, But we're not in despair. We know where we're going. We know who we follow. We know what we are to do. We are persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Whatever are the worst case faith situation that we face, we know that God is in control of circumstances. And if we have to go through it, and we have to learn lessons, then we need to apply ourselves and seek and learn that, and knowing that one of the main lessons we have to learn is to have more faith. Lord, help my unbelief. Struck down but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body. He was willing to die for us. Are we willing, if necessary, to die for him? The answer has to be yes. And that's not an answer that you can blithely say. It's something that has to come in personal meditation and prayer. Thinking it through. But in a heartbeat, Christ died for us, we will die for him. And until that time comes, if that time comes in our case, many die of ripe old age in the faith. And that's a wonderful blessing. But if it doesn't fall our lot to do that, then we will live for him as well. It has to be one or the other, but we have to be fearless. Worst case situations mean that you have to not be fearful of what man can do. We fear only God. And that is a fear of love, you know, that is born of love. Always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our body. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So then death is working in us, but life in you. Paul and some of the elders, like Silas and Barnabas too, were taking the brunt of the persecution to protect the brethren. You know, Paul was a lightning rod, and to a degree that protected a lot of brethren in many respects when the lightning struck. And since we have the same spirit of faith, again, there it is, same spirit of faith, no matter if we're in a worst-case situation, we have a spirit of faith. According to what is written, I believed, and therefore I spoke. We also believe, and therefore speak. And you think about that. You know, I give a lecture at the leadership weekend we have coming up. We have 70 men and wives coming to the leadership weekend. This is the biggest one we ever had. The only one that came close to it was last year. We just crammed them in. I don't know how we're going to get them into the lecture hall or fit them into services there at the home office. I'm not sure how we're going to do that, but we have 70 coming. We're going to be a big shoehorn, I think, is probably what we'll need. But one of the lecture I give to the fellows is about preaching, and it is, I believe, therefore I speak. You know, we have to believe in order to be able to speak of belief. We have to be fully, deeply convinced of the truth before we can expound the truth. Well, likewise, when it comes not to expounding it, but just being able to speak it personally, we must believe. We also believe and therefore speak, knowing that he who raised up the Lord Jesus will also raise us up with Jesus and will present us with you. Now, Paul meant he may raise us up physically now, or maybe not, but we will be raised up with Christ. For all things are for your sakes, that grace may be spread through the many, and may cause thanksgiving to abound to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart. When we face worst case faith, don't lose heart. Steel ourselves for it. This is the serious end of true Christianity. Is facing your worst case situations faithfully. Even though our outward man is perishing. And it is, because we're getting older. All of us are getting older. The inward man is being renewed day by day. See, what is important is not our physical lives, it's our spiritual lives. The priority has to be clear. Yes, we want to live, you know, a life abundantly, as God promised through Christ in John 10:10. that I came that they may have an abundant have life and have it more abundantly, I think is how it reads. Oh, yes, indeed. We look to that. But there are times when we must stop and think about the worst-case situation so that we're prepared for it when it comes, that we are not surprised as if some strange thing happened to us, but that we can have a song in our hearts like David and Habakkuk did that carry us through looking to God and have even the as yet imperfect conviction, but the sound part of Job's was, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Whatever we face, or have to face, God is with us. For our light affliction, and weigh this in the view of eternal life in the kingdom of God, which we will thoroughly, wonderfully enjoy and revel in. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. It's too easy to look at the things that are seen, the stuff we have, the things we want to do, places we want to go and look at. We must look at the things which are not seen. Primarily, enjoy the things that are seen within balance, but primarily look at the things that are not seen. That is the as yet invisible kingdom of God, because it isn't here yet. When it's here, it'll be clearly visible. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So Paul understood worst case faith. He had lots of it, and he had lots of practice building it. Because he was constantly in a worst-case situation, perhaps as much or more than any other servant of Christ was. Now, the clincher is in John 21. I think it's the clincher situation or account that teaches us the lesson. And this is the worst case wasn't in John 21. I mean, that was a fish fry. It was a fishing trip, no less. Peter and there were seven of the apostles to be who had gone to Galilee because Christ said, go to Galilee and wait until I come. So they did. And while they're waiting, they went out one night fishing, which is what a bunch of them were actually professional fishermen, Peter and Andrew and James and John at the very least, and perhaps others. And they didn't catch anything, and so when they're in the early morning light, they see somebody vaguely in the mist on the shore shouting, "Do they have any fish?" And they said, "No, we don't have any." He said, "Well, cast your net on the other side of the boat and you'll catch some." Fish finder. He'd been to Cabela's. So they did, and they caught more than they could get into the boats. These were rowboats, and they had more large fish than they're afraid they were going to swamp the boat. So they're dragging the net. It's a casting net, round casting net, really. A lot of fun to fish with a casting net, but I won't tell you how to do that right now. They caught so many that they had to drag the net between the boats, and then they recognized, John did, that's the Lord. And so Peter dives in and swims to shore. He was always enthusiastic. He didn't walk to shore. He tried that once before, and he wasn't as good on it as Christ, walking on the water. But he could swim, so he swam to shore, plus he had to help beach the boats as they came up. And when they all got up there, Christ had fish on the fire and bread being cooked, which he had already begun to prepare. And he said, bring some more of those fish, fellows. We're going to have a fish fry. So they had their fish fry, and they sat there in the early morning light on the Sea of Galilee on the shore. And when they had eaten breakfast, this is afterwards, everybody's full and marveling. Here is Jesus, their dear friend, their brother, in some cases probably cousin, literally a physical cousin. That's a possibility with regards to James and John. Mary's sister may have been their mother. That is one of the historical speculations, at least. It doesn't matter. They were all close to him as if they were cousins and brothers. When they'd eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, he singles Peter out. He said, Simon, son of Jonah, Simon Bar-Jonah, why do you love me more than these? Referring to everybody else. He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, well, feed my lambs. And he said to him a second time, okay, you know, Peter nods his head, you know, he's waiting for some famous last words that he can remember from Christ, even though he's hearing them after he's been resurrected. And he assumes it's done, I presume, and then he says a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He didn't say the more than these this time, and he says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my sheep, or tend my sheep. And then he said a third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? It had to be putting the emphasis on different syllables each time to gain the impact, and or emphasis on syllables, depending on how you say it. Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? You know, he was a little exasperated. Why is he saying this to me? What's wrong? And he said, Lord, you know all things, and you know that I love you. And then he said to him, feed my sheep. So why did he repeat it three times? How many times did Peter deny Christ before the rooster crowed? Poetic justice, but also a profound lesson. Not lost on the rest of the apostles by any means. They're sitting there too. And so he says, truly I tell you that when you're younger, you were younger, you girded yourself, you dressed yourself, and you walked where you wanted to. But when you're old, you'll stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you don't want to go, where you do not wish. This he spoke, signifying what death he would glorify God. In other words, Peter would die a martyr in a very painful, horrendous death. Tradition says that, in fact, that happened. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. Worst case faith, follow Christ. Ah, but we're not done. We have an addendum. Then Peter, one thing about Peter, he wasn't bashful. He turned around and he saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now he's talking about John, because that's how John referred to himself. That if any of the 12 were, John was Christ's best friend on earth and possibly one of his cousins. Following, who had leaned on his breast in the supper, and when he had said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? Again, identifying John as identifying himself from earlier chapter. And Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about him? What about John? What's going to happen to him? And Jesus said, if I will, if I desire that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Now that sank in, because Peter didn't ask any more questions. Doesn't matter if I let John live till I return. And John goes on to explain, he didn't say that he would live until he returned. He just said, and he quoted him, so he'd be really precise about it. He said, whatever happens to anybody else, you follow me. You know, Jesus said that to Peter, but he could just as easily have said it to you and me, every one of us, every one of God's people, down through the ages, those who were truly converted. He said it to every one of us. He said, you follow me. In worst case faith situation, we ask God for more faith and we follow Christ.